You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. On the program today, thinking about economic data and the economic thinking inside the White House. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday today, the 31st of August, end of the month. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The economic view from inside the Biden White House in a little bit. First, though, a view of the economic data and the lessons therein. We told you yesterday that the revision in economic growth of the second quarter, April through June, included the tidbit that consumers had spent even more during those 3 months than we had originally thought. Today, we learned they kept spending in July. Personal income and outlays is the data set. The Bureau of Economic Analysis is the source. And it turns out that last month, consumers spent more on both goods and services, despite the Fed's best efforts to get us to cool it. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on why and what it all means.
If spending earlier in the year was about getting ready for a summer of revenge travel, Jay Zagorski at Boston University's Questrom School of Business says now,
we're starting to get back to more normal times where you've done your travel and it's now time to sort of hunker down a little bit more at home.
That gave people one reason to spend 0.9% more on goods in July than in June. And that's despite higher interest rates jacking up credit card bills and those student loan repayments about to kick back in for some. Eric Lund is principal economist at the Conference Board.
The U.S. consumer is not giving in, is continuing to spend. But I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, how long can this run for?
Quite a while, according to an upcoming report from Near Intelligence, which tracks consumer behavior.
More Americans are saying that they're planning to spend more for the rest of the year, including holidays.
Christina Tipton is the company's director of market research.
43% said that they're planning to spend more for the remainder of the year, compared to 39% spending about the same and 18% spending less.
So on balance, people seem to not be that worried about splurging a bit, at least until the bills start coming due. Stephanie Tully teaches consumer behavior at USC's Marshall School of Business.
Whether or not people will shift their spending has more to do with the realities of getting those bills, but people aren't great about anticipating that in advance. And so until those bills come, it's unlikely that it is going to change spending in advance.
But for now, it's still hot spend summer. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Sharp-eyed observers of government economic data releases will know that we also got the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index this morning, PCE for short. It is the Fed's go-to measure of inflation, as we say from time to time. Up 0.2% month to month, 3.3% year on year. 2%, as you know, is the Fed's much-missed sweet spot. Wall Street, as the week heads to a close, mixed, but modestly. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We break down spending in this economy, very broadly speaking, into two categories, goods and services. And in July, our spending on goods was 0.9% higher than it was in June. And a big contributor to that increase, it turns out, was more spending on games, toys, and hobbies. So we sent Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes out to check on the fun and games section of this economy.
Imani White and Ethan Childs popped into Canton Games today. They've come not only to shop, but to play a game of Magic the Gathering.
You can mulligan again.
I'm not going to mulligan again.
Not going to do it.
No, I'm going to play a land and I'm going to pass turn.
Okay. Yeah.
They're planning to buy some new Magic cards, too. Childs says he spends about $500 a year on the game.
obviously it's not a small number. It's more, it's...
I mean, but it's a hobby that you love, hobby, you know? Like, yeah. It's a safe hobby. It's social. It's, we also play it socially. It's not like you're, like, hoarding all these cards.
After a summer of spending on travel and concerts, it seems people are putting money towards things as a way to connect with others. The store also sells vintage video games and boutique board games like Baltimoreopoly. Lindsay Farrell, who works there, says she sees a bump in business anytime a big storm is forecast and people know they'll be together.
I've heard we're going to get a wet winter, so I'm anticipating a lot of people coming in like, what can I play with no lights on, that sort of thing.
A few blocks over at Tochterman's Fishing Tackle, customers bond with salespeople about the best spots to find rockfish in Baltimore come winter.
Hospital, what's it?
Oh, over at the
Hanover Bridge? Yeah, we'll go over there because there's a discharge that comes up underneath warm water. I don't know what the discharge is. Maybe it's an old broken pipe.
It's an old pipe, yes.
One of the store's owner, Tony Tochterman, says sales aren't as crazy as 2 years ago. But these days, about a third of his clientele are sharing the hobby with their families.
The grandparents are coming in here to buy their grandchildren their outfits.
Just up the street, Luann Cara welcomes me into her gallery, where art is for sale, including a life-size mosaic mermaid she created, displayed in a room with sounds of the seashore. She also teaches classes in mosaic making, figure drawing, even yoga, and expects participation to go up now that summer's ending.
Everybody's starting to go in energetically and, you know, just relax a little bit. And that's the time when people want to take classes and make gifts for people.
And she says, just spend time with each other. In Fells Point in Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Okay, after all that seeing what the data says, how the White House sees this economy. The Council of Economic Advisors is three people, economists, to be clear, sort of an in-house policy shop for the president, coming up with and keeping an eye on the implementation of the administration's economic agenda. Heather Boucher is one of those three economists on the Biden CEA. She's been there since the beginning, early in 2021, and she is here in the studio today. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
It's funny to have people here. I want to start big picture, very big picture, and I want your reaction to what I'm about to say. Would it be fair for me to characterize what the Biden administration is doing with the economy as the biggest change in how the government interacts with this economy, certainly since Lyndon Johnson, maybe since FDR? What do you think?
I think that this president came into office saying that he wanted to change the paradigm because he saw that the United States was facing a series of crises, the pandemic, but also these long-standing economic challenges, almost, you know, half a century of rising economic inequality, the fact that our supply chains had become so fragile and brittle over time. So I would agree with you. This is a historic set of investments the president is making, in large part working hand-in-hand with Congress on a bipartisan basis to invest in America, and doing so in a way that is making sure that markets work, that they are competitive, that they function for small businesses and consumers and workers alike.
Bipartisan by the hair of his chinny chin chin, it has to be pointed out, right? I mean, let's
still,
be fair about this.
That's an accomplishment.
Fair enough. I'll give you the point, even though margins matter. One of the things you do now in the White House is you are the chief economist for a group of cabinet officers that's called the Investing in America subcabinet, right? And basically your remit, as it were, is to encourage and motivate private investment in this economy, in part by public investment, all the money that Congress and the president have approved. Here's my question. These are multi-billion dollar companies that you are looking to make these investments, whether it's cars or semiconductors or what have you. Why do they need government money to do their business?
A few reasons. what we make in America and how we make it truly matters, and that what is so important. Sometimes the private sector needs a little bit of help because there's what an economist would call a coordination failure or a network effect or something. Think about the case of electric vehicles, right? So for a century, we've all been driving these gas-powered cars, and there's gas stations everywhere. So when you need to fuel up, you can, and mechanics that know how to use them and all the things. Making a transition to a new way of powering how we transport ourselves requires a new set of charging networks. It requires a new set of skills, you know, batteries instead of powertrain vehicles. And for any one business, being that first mover is really risky and really expensive. What's going to come first, the charging network or the new cars? And so a key part of so many of the investments that the president has made is saying, hey, where do markets need a little bit of help to make sure that we're meeting national and economic security goals?
Let's stick with EVs for a second, because you have a two-headed problem here. You have to incentivize corporations, right, to invest in the charging stations and the high power lines and making the EVs. But you also have to incentivize consumers, because if we ain't buying, they ain't making. How do you do that?
Well, already, every single state has a plan to put in place their piece of the puzzle to get those charging networks up and running. So that's a supply side. And then on the other side, there are tax credits for consumers. So if you purchase a car that's on the list, you can get up to a $7,500 tax credit. You know, it's solving both sides of that problem.
Can we talk time scale here for a minute? Because none of these charging stations are going up tomorrow morning, right? And EV sales, while booming, are still, you know, a small fraction of what we're doing. So it's going to take, roughly speaking, decades for the Biden administration's investments to pay out. Rather than ask you how you're going to know when it succeeds, because you'll be out of your job and I'll be out of my job and hopefully we're still around, what are you looking for early markers-wise?
Well, I think we are already seeing a lot of progress. We're seeing a really sharp uptick in the people who are out there buying electric vehicles. You see them all over the roads. I've been driving all around California. Every time I look, there's a, you know, different kinds of electric vehicles.
We do love our EVs out here,
well,
right?
And there's a lot of charging stations, so that all helps.
Although many of them don't work. Let me just say, as an EV owner, it's a little distressing, right? So you've got some repair work to
that
do,
That is important. There's a lot of IT jobs, as it turns out.
Did you rent an EV?
I both own an EV and we rented one here.
Right.
So super fun. But, you know, the thing that we're also looking for, especially in year one, is for the private sector to step up and make investments. And what we have seen is this sort of incredible new investment in manufacturing construction. We're seeing costs come down. You know, at this point, solar and wind are, you know, solar is actually now the cheapest form of energy that you can, use. So we're looking for all of those interim steps, and I think we're starting to see a lot of them.
All of this comes under the general heading of industrial policy, right?
We like to call it industrial strategy, but yes.
Fair enough. potato, patata. I guess the question is, why do we have to have one?
Well, because without it, businesses were not making the needed investments in the things that matter most to the U.S. economy.
American business is doing fine. Thank you very much.
I said that businesses were not making the needed investments in the things that matter most. We just came through a pandemic where Americans could not get cars that they wanted because we did not have access to semiconductors because of the fragility of our global supply chains.
So let's talk about this president for a minute. With the acknowledgement that you're a policy official and not a campaign official, I do have to ask you about how the public feels about how the president's doing with this economy. And the short answer is lousy. Something like 39% approve in the latest AP poll on how the president's doing. And I guess my question is, if the economy is good, which let's stipulate here it is, right? Unemployment at generational lows, inflation's coming down, economy is growing, the economy is good. What do you have to do to convince the public that that's true? Because it's not resonating.
So first off, we've just lived through a global pandemic that has upended business as usual for workers, for small businesses, for big businesses, and we've seen it, you know, affect prices. I think it's been very unsettling, right, psychologically for people all across the country, all across the world. What we see in the data is a number of things, as you just mentioned, historic lows in unemployment. We have not seen the unemployment rate be this low for this long in over 50 years. And we're also seeing that workers are reporting that they have very high job satisfaction. what we need, you know, what I think the president hopes is that people see that a lot of this is because of the decisions he made and his willingness to work across the aisle and to focus, really importantly, on building an economy from the middle out.
I don't want to be flip here, but hope doesn't get you 270 electoral votes, right? And well, he now has, look, and you're a policy person, not a campaign official. I get that. And if you don't want to go there, I'll understand. But he has a fundamental challenge in making people understand what part of the economy he gets credit for.
Well, you know what I see is we see these investments going up all across the United States, in red states and in blue states. People are also seeing battery plants going up in their community. They're seeing the fact that they have a job, their cousin has a job, and they are seeing the fact that prices have been coming down from the highs that they were early last summer.
Heather Boucher, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up,
it's probably my number one issue, the so-called silver tsunami.
Ain't nobody getting any younger, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 168 points today, about a half percent, 34,721 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ ticked up 15 points, about a tenth percent, 14,034. The S&P 500 off 7, two-tenths percent. 45.7 there. We were just talking about consumer spending a couple of minutes ago, so let's check in on some retailers, shall we? Dollar Tree stock slipped 1.7% today. TJX Companies, that includes Home Goods and Sierra Trading Post, added 0.4%. Costco bulked up 1.3%. Walmart gained about 0.9% today. Dining out and food takeaway expenditures are also part of that household spending trend. You know, Chipotle lost 0.6%. Starbucks dipped 1.8%. Yum Brands, KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, under that umbrella, down 0.6%. Today, Swiss bank UBS posted hefty quarterly profits to the tune of nearly, wait for it, $29 billion. Here's the caveat. It's the first earnings report since taking over rival Credit Suisse. UBS also announced layoffs of thousands of people as it completes that acquisition. That's the way those things go. Shares of UBS listed on the New York Stock Exchange jumped 5.6%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I regret to inform you, ladies and gentlemen, that the United States is no longer the world's leading exporter of corn. So says U.S. Department of Agriculture data for the year ending today. Brazil is now number one after more than a half century in which the United States had a near lock on that top position. That reordering of the global corn hierarchy follows a similar erosion in U.S. exports of other staple commodities, think wheat here and soybeans, over the past decade or so. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino digs into what that all means.
Corn is still America's biggest crop, It's also a link to indigenous traditions, a symbol of the country's productivity and prosperity, and a source of homegrown pride.
Actually, the town where I'm at has a sweet corn festival and different events that center around corn.
Krista Swanson is the lead economist for the National Corn Growers Association and a corn farmer in Illinois. She says the past year has thrown U.S. growers some curveballs.
The 22 crop that we produced in the United States was reduced by drought and was lower than, you know, where it would have been otherwise.
A strong dollar boosted by rising interest rates also made U.S. corn less competitive.
This is something that has been predicted for many, many years, our forecast.
Joseph Glauber is a senior research fellow at the Food Policy Research Institute and former chief economist at the USDA. He notes more U.S. corn is being bought domestically for biofuels and livestock. Meanwhile, Brazil has been harvesting record amounts of the grain.
Essentially through intensification, that is, they'll plant a double crop. They'll follow their soybean crop with a crop of corn.
Brazil has found an eager buyer in China, says Stephen Nicholson, the global sector strategist for grains at Rabobank.
I think we have a little bit of a hangover from the Trump tariffs. And, you know, with that, the Chinese are saying, you know, we'll take our business someplace else.
Despite losing market share to Brazil, U.S. growers are still selling more in absolute terms, says Scott Irwin, an agriculture economist at the University of Illinois. He says it's what happened with soybeans 10 years ago.
And U.S. farm income has not fallen out of bed because we lost that spot.
In a sign of changing times, or maybe just a coincidence, this year's Indiana Corn Queen pageant has a special theme, Brazilian Carnival. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Lest you'd forgotten the theme with which we started this week, jobs, it is still with us. We've talked wages and jobs added last month. We've talked job openings and layoffs, all with the general tenor of a gradually slowing labor market, which is what's supposed to have been happening as the Fed's been raising interest rates. However, comma, there are still almost 1.5 job openings for every job seeker. Whatever the jobless rate turns out to be when we get the August unemployment report tomorrow morning, odds are high it's still going to be near a 50-year low. And the fact of the matter is that we've had stubborn labor shortages for years now. That's the case in sectors all across this economy, from skilled trades to leisure and hospitality and healthcare to high tech. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, that could be the state of things for a while.
From his office on the outskirts of Chicago, Jim Piper looks down on the shop floor of his manufacturing company, Matot, where about 40 workers cut, bend, and weld sheet metal to make dumbwaiters and industrial lifts for clients across the country.
We're fortunate to be as busy as we are. We have a strong backlog of work for new restaurants, healthcare, and manufacturing, many of the new semiconductor plants that are being built.
But, Piper says, finding new skilled workers is a problem he thinks about every day.
It's probably my number one issue, the so-called silver tsunami. We have several employees on our shop floor that have been with us for over 40 years. And they're the backbone of our manufacturing facility, but we recognize that we're going to need to replace them soon.
This was the crisis we could see coming. Excess supply of labor caused by the size of the baby boom has now come to an end.
That's Joe Bruzuelas, chief economist at consulting firm RSM.
The onset of the pandemic, with the acceleration of the retirement of the boomers, has now created a confluence of events where we have a labor shortage that's verging on a crisis. That's going to cause big changes in firms with respect to wages and flexibility.
Workers aged 25 to 54 have largely returned to the workforce. But participation among older workers, those 55 and over, remains about 1.5% lower than it was before the pandemic. Sharon Block is a labor expert at Harvard Law School.
Because of their increased vulnerability, we saw older workers during the pandemic leave the labor force. If we see an upsurge or something unexpected with COVID, I think you would expect to see that again accelerate.
Joe Bruzuelas says some people who retired early might be forced to unretire and return to work out of economic necessity.
But there's not enough of them to make a difference.
Because every year, retiring boomers will outnumber returnees by a bigger and bigger margin. So Teresa Carroll at workforce management firm Magnet says labor shortages are likely to persist, driving wages up in leisure and hospitality, healthcare, construction, and manufacturing.
Skilled trades, the shortage there is very significant. Nursing has gone through its increase in wages because of the aging of the population and the need for more healthcare workers.
But are these labor shortages new? Are they really labor shortages? Former Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner Erica Groshen says employers have been complaining about not being able to find qualified workers for decades.
With nurses, I don't know of a time in my professional life that there hasn't been a quote-unquote shortage of nurses.
Groshen says what some call an economy-wide labor shortage is really a failure by employers to offer pay high enough to get workers off the sidelines.
In the long run, in a macroeconomic sense, it's not what economists would call a labor shortage. It is a period of time during which wages have to rise.
Now, employers would say they can't afford to increase wages indefinitely. Some will invest in more automation and AI to keep their labor costs down. Looking at the challenges he faces staffing his Chicago area sheet metal shop, Jim Piper says schools, employers, and nonprofits need to better prepare young people for the entry-level jobs he has on offer, starting at $18 to $22 an hour.
We just need to get them trained. Put shop classes back into high schools, provide vocational training, give them that basic set of skills using hand tools and power tools and understanding basic measurement techniques.
Piper is confident he'll find young people from Chicago schools to do this work, just as well as the aging boomers they'll be replacing. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which money talks, as usual, saw this on Bloomberg, that some shipping companies are paying millions of dollars, as much as $2.4 million in one case, to skip the long line of ships waiting to transit the Panama Canal. Turns out, filling the locks of the canal takes 55 million gallons of fresh water per transit, and they're having a drought down there, so there is less water, thus ships gotta wait. Or pay. All right, we are going, but not, of course, without your moment of economic context. And if you missed her on tour, fear not. The Taylor Swift Eras Tour film is coming soon to an AMC theater near you, October the 13th, to be clear. So you have to wait a little while. AMC shares today, by the way, finished down 1.4% after an early Swifty bounce. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diane Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawi is the managing editor. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.